As Americans head to the polls, many worry a second term for President Donald Trump could usher in the end of democracy in the so-called land of the free. In this week's Upfront Special, we debate whether democracy across the globe is in peril and talk about the rise of strongman leaders. Is democracy under attack across the world? According to a report released earlier this year, the majority of the world's countries are now autocracies. That's for the first time since 2001. The rise of right-wing so-called strongman leaders in recent years, from Donald Trump in the U.S. to Viktor Orban in Hungary and Narendra Modi in India, has fueled fears that liberal values are at risk. But is all this talk of democracy dying overblown? And what makes a true democracy anyway? Joining me to debate this are Ruth Ben-Ghiata, historian and professor at New York University, and the author of the book Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Shadi Hamid, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. And Ashley Farmer, an assistant professor at the University of Texas, Austin, and the author of the book Remaking Black Power, How Black Women Transformed an Era. Thank you all for joining me on Upfront. So, Ruth, I want to start with you. In your book, Strong Men, you said that combating authoritarian ascension is one of the most pressing issues of our time. So does that mean you see, conversely, that democracy is on the decline and, in fact, even under attack?
I do very much. And in the book and in my writings, I draw attention to the way that, although authoritarianism has often been presented by U.S. and their own propaganda as a stable and productive system of government, it's actually extremely destructive, causing harm to business, causing communities of exiles, draining the nation of talent, and as we've seen, often handling national health crises like the coronavirus very badly. So I conclude that it's an existential threat.
I want your input on this, Shadi. Do you think that democracy is on the decline?
Democracy is on the decline in the world writ large, but we have to be specific about what we're talking about. If we're talking about the U.S., I think there's only one conclusion to reach, and that's American democracy, for all of its flaws, is still a democracy. It's still functioning. We've had a vigorous opposition to Donald Trump. And I think for me, the last 4 years have been something of a relief that it could have been much worse. Everyone who was predicting that Trump would make America into some kind of pseudo-dictatorship, they've been proven wrong definitively. And hopefully we'll have further confirmation of that fact after the elections next week. So that's a more optimistic spin, I suppose. And I think words matter. And the danger in saying that America is no longer a democracy, then words don't really mean much at all. It doesn't make sense to compare the U.S. to actual authoritarian regimes. And this is coming from someone like me who thinks Trump is really bad, but badness is not the same as dictatorship.
Ashley, I want your thoughts on this. Chadi saying, yeah, it's bad, but it could have been much worse. What do you see as the state of democracy right now?
Well, I think you have to think about who is talking about what democracy is and for whom. For many African Americans living in the United States and other marginalized populations, the question of whether the U.S. is a robust democracy has always been a question and under threat. I agree that we can't engage in kind of hyperbolic comparisons between some of the genocides that are happening around the world in authoritarian dictatorships and what's happening here. But I'd like to remind people that, you know, we could also say that African Americans have been under a sustained genocidal plot to exterminate and marginalize them out of democracy for the better part of several centuries.
So, okay, let's talk about what you're saying there, Ashley, that in a lot of ways the issues are much bigger than Trump. The history of women, of people of color, being marginalized in the democracy that is the U.S., what role did that play to you and how we've gotten to this point?
Well, I think we have to think about race and democracy on two fronts, right? So a democracy kind of broadly defined as majority rule and active participation, it's been baked into the very fabric of America from the Constitution to today of a marginalization of majority African Americans, but also minority other minority groups, indigenous people, women, immigrants, et cetera, right? In addition to that, we have to think about how race functions as a way of moving us towards authoritarian regimes. Race is a way of othering people. You then stoke fears about that other as opposition to American democracy and democratic ideals. And then you kind of create this conspiracy theory that these others, largely African Americans, but not exclusively in the sense of Trump immigrants, right, are coming to take your land or your nation, and you need to get behind a leader. So, I mean, you know, the act of race and racism in the United States has not only made it so that large amounts of people cannot participate in democracy, but also has been a very big tool for moving us towards authoritarian rhetoric, if not regimes.
And that race.
I would also.
Go ahead, Ruth.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in and say this is backed up by history. Over and over around the world, strongmen appeal when a country has had, they often find favor when a country has just had a significant progress toward racial, gender, class equity. And that's exactly when these individuals find favor as a way of kind of turning back the clock, and they promise national greatness, but it's at the price of taming these others who should learn their place and go back to where they were before. So
Ruth,
this is a dynamic that is now.
Let me ask you about that, because you've written about various people in your book, and it sounds like what you're talking about is also something that Jair Bolsonaro has been doing in Brazil as well, that other leaders have. It used to be a dog whistle, but it's really loud and plain right now, the kinds of signals that they're sending to people. They tap into race, socioeconomic background. Talk more about how they use those types of things to whip up what is basically white nationalism.
Yeah, and this differs, of course, from country to country,
sure.
But they legitimize and energize existing anti-democratic and extremist and racist tendencies. And in the case of Brazil, from the very start, Bolsonaro posed himself as kind of reactivating the authoritarian energies of Brazil's military dictatorship, but also made himself the voice of the white European decided minority in Brazil as a kind of, guard against others who are not white European-born minorities or origin minorities getting power. So it's all the more marked what has happened in Brazil. And there's also this recourse. Bolsonaro is backed by evangelical Christians. So that's this alliance that you see repeatedly at play, including in the United States.
I'd just like to add that, I mean, you know, and you see this kind of playbook with Trump's administration here. It started with, you know, make America great again, which is a huge dog whistle to let's go back to a time when white people didn't feel infringed upon. And then we see him going to law and order. And then most recently in, you know, the debate, not the last one, but the one before, we see him just unwilling to disavow white nationalism. So it went from this kind of dog-whistled, veiled understanding of we were going back to whiteness, segregation, and xenophobia. And now it's just, you know, unveiled white nationalism.
Okay, let's talk more about Trump. And Shadi, my next question was to you, Shadi, but go ahead.
I was just going to say that we have to separate between things here. I mean, racism is racism. That's not the same as being authoritarian. So when we talk about democracy, we're talking about, in the procedural sense, alternation of power through regular elections. We're talking about being accountable to the majority or to a plurality of voters. Democracies can still embark on racist policies. So when we're saying, when we're kind of conflating these things, I think we're losing a little bit of precision. Racism is bad, but it's bad for different reasons. It's immoral for different reasons.
But racism can also be a tool of an authoritarian, can it not?
Certainly a tool, yeah. Yeah, and I think there are any number of examples of that. But again, I mean, the U.S. has been embarking on race, especially in previous eras of our history. You know, we've had racist policies on the institutional level. Again, does that mean that we were an authoritarian state in, you know, 50 or 60 years ago or even 30 years ago? I mean, that's sort of what we're talking about here.
Okay, so let's keep talking about Donald Trump in the U.S. right now, because early voting has been going on for a few weeks, record turnout. The official election day is just a few days away, but Donald Trump has been relentless in his attacks on the integrity of the election, questioning ballots, questioning mail-in votes. He specifically said, we're going to have to see what happens. The ballots are a disaster. The ballots are out of control. You know it. That is a quote from Donald Trump. So some people are concerned that he might not go if he loses. He might not go quietly. The hallmark of a democracy is a peaceful transfer of power. Ruth, do people, are they right to be concerned, or are they overreacting?
Here's the thing. There's a reason, although I've spent decades studying fascism, I never called Donald Trump a fascist. Because every authoritarianism evolves over 100 years. And it's not going to look like Hitler's Germany or Mussolini's Italy today. And today, authoritarians come in through elections, and then they manipulate elections to stay in power. And so I think that in warning, since I started warning in 2016, before Trump was elected, that he had authoritarian tendencies. And as Shadi says, it is silly to say that. I mean, no one is saying, I hope, that America is a dictatorship, because we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't be doing all the work we're doing in the States. My book wouldn't be coming out if that were true. But all these leaders started somewhere. And even Mussolini was a prime minister of a democracy for 3 years before he declared dictatorship. But even leaving aside, if we go to the 21st century, look at what Orban's been able to do. He now rules by decree. He's completely domesticated the media, and he's done this without significant physical violence. So if we look at how authoritarianism is an evolution rather than a revolution today, then for me, it's very safe to say that we are heading in that direction. We're not there yet, but what is there? What is there going to look like? It's going to look different in every time and place.
So, Shadi, let me ask you this. You said, I don't believe that Donald Trump is a fascist or a dictator in the making. I don't believe America is a failed state. And you've also been very specific to talk about words, because words matter. You said that you like to think of Donald Trump more as an illiberal Democrat. You think that is the proper term for him. Obviously, nuance matters, words matters, proportionality matters. Having said that, how do you think he will react to the election if you consider him an illiberal Democrat?
So I think he'll complain about the results. He'll attack them. He'll try to, you know, rally his base and get them angry. But if the results are clear and they're certified and there's media coverage about who won, and we may have to wait for a few days to get a fuller sense of the results as mail-in ballots come in, I mean, Trump can't stay in the White House against everyone else's will. We have institutions. If Biden is the clear winner, Republicans as a party will understand that the wind is blowing in a particular direction, and they're not going to fall down with they're not going to sink with a sinking ship. And in this case, the sinking ship will be Donald Trump. And this is where I think there's a big difference between America today and, say, Germany or Italy in the 20s or 30s. Those were young democracies that didn't have a lot of history of democratic competition. We're one of the oldest democracies in the world. And moreover, most Americans believe in the American idea. People, you know, there's less pride in America.
Isn't it clear that maybe a lot of Americans don't, considering how many supporters Donald Trump has? He has 60 million people. I mean, I think that makes clear there's a significant chunk of Americans that are, in fact, not committed to this universal ideal that we all thought.
No, I mean, those are our fellow Americans. I don't think that we should see the 60 million people who voted for Trump as deplorables. I disagree with them. I think they have bad ideas, but we're still part of the American family, so to speak. And I think that if you ask most of them, do you believe in America, in the founding documents, in the Declaration, in the Constitution, and 1776 matters, I think most of them would say yes. I mean, there's a small percentage of...
Who do they believe in that for? That is the question. They may believe in that for a certain segment, but they're holding on for dear life to make sure everybody doesn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Ashley.
I would add two points.
First is I am also in agreement that I would not say that we are in a fascist dictatorship. What I would say is we can look to the Americans who voted for Trump and their issues with Black people, immigrants, et cetera, and their willingness to allow the American nation state to exert kind of authoritarian or bordering on authoritarian rhetoric and or strategies to make sure that they are not part of the American dream or the kind of democratic ideals that we all are living up to as an harbinger of possible things to come, right? There is an entire part of this population that really lives in a subjugated and different understanding of American democracy and rules than the majority of folks that Donald Trump is talking about and appealing to. And that deals exclusively engages in state-sponsored oppression, lack of freedom of speech, lack of freedom of movement, et cetera, that are all very much kind of the canary in the coal mine of what the state is willing to do to its citizens and what we should be careful to watch out for.
Ruth, you wanted to...
But when... I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Shadi. Go ahead.
I'll just very quickly. I mean, when Trump says and does racist things, so I, as a Muslim and an Arab, we have experienced some of Trump's racism with the Muslim ban or the travel ban, whatever you want to call it, when he became president. But what was so great about being in this country as an American Muslim is that we didn't say that, oh, we're going to leave or we have to give up on America and it's too late for America. We said, no, we're going to fight back and we're going to claim these. We're going to say we're just as American as anyone else. And that Trump is violating the American idea. And we were able to make that case. And that's what Americans do every single day. Black and brown people who face police brutality and so on, when they argue against it, most of the time they're saying this goes against the American idea. We can become better. And we believe in the idea of progress. So that to me suggests that people aren't giving up hope. They're saying that America has the potential to improve, and we're in a constant state of improving ourselves, and that's been part of the American story, getting better than the way we were before.
Okay, so let me put this to Ruth. So in a way, it sounds like what Shadi is describing is, for lack of a better term, almost growing pains in a way, and that there is a mechanism for protest and such because our democracy is largely functioning, even though it is being tested. Do you agree with that, Ruth?
Oh, absolutely. It's an enormous laboratory right now, starting with the fact that Americans are very different than many other populations in the world, and that they have never had foreign occupation. They've never had an experience of national dictatorship. And although I don't actually believe we're an old democracy, because until African Americans had civil rights and could vote, we were not a democracy. The other thing I want to point out, which is very sobering, there's been a lot of comparative politics studies coming out about the GOP. Pippa Norris at Harvard and others have done these studies that place the platform of the GOP in comparative perspective with many other parties and find that it is a very, when you look at its positions and also the way it's acted in the leader-follower relationship with Trump, its 2020 platform was just empty of all content except let's support Trump. He's wrapped them around, his finger. So the GOP is actually, in many respects, a far-right party ideologically, and it lines up, as these studies show, with Erdogan's party on certain things, with Modi's party. And so I think that what I've tried to do I'm not a historian of America, my parents are not American, and I come to this with a global viewpoint. And I looked at how Trump maps on very well to this kind of authoritarian-leaning playbook. And so does the GOP. The way the GOP has behaved with him conforms.
Ashley, I want to pick up on something that Ruth said specifically about the Republican Party. Donald Trump said back in March, in reference to trying to make voting easier and give as many people, an easier time at the poll, he said, "You never have a Republican elected in this country again." He said that out loud in reference to not suppressing the vote. And as I said, over the course of history, Black people and women have been disenfranchised, right? And it's clear that the Republican Party mm-hmm. has made an effort to have as few people participate in the process as possible. Having said that, what do you make of this almost the country convulsing in a way with protests over the last few months of people trying to use their voice, people who have not been able to use their voice for so long.
Yeah, I mean, I think this brings up two points. So, yes, we have never had a dictatorship or foreign occupation. But that being said, the checks and balances aren't working in the same, in the best ways that everybody thinks there is. I mean, Black people more than anybody on kind of in this group have believed in the American dream and fought for it. But nevertheless, we still continue to fall short and not live up to those democratic ideals. One of the things that has always worked in the past for us is going to the streets and making a broader call for democracy than we do maybe just at the ballot box, especially being disenfranchised. And I think what that's done for a lot of people is made them realize how different of a world Black people live in than the majority of white people, and how tenuous their own rights are if you can watch on loop Black people being shot in the street, if you can watch on loop people being turned away at the polls. And so, like I said before, really the index of a democracy is how the quote-unquote lowest of the low are able to engage in its basic, you know, participatory principles. And Black people have shown, despite our, you know, kind of robust interest in America, nobody seems to be more kind of, you know, supporting America and saying we are American more than us because we built it, there still is a willful effort to kind of negate us from the even the basic principles.
If Donald Trump wins the election, what do you think that means for democracy in the U.S.?
Well, I think that it's clear that it is going in a direction where the checks and balances are not as robust as we think they are. Yes, he can be quote-unquote Democratic elected, but we also know that the GOP is willing to get behind him and become a party that is invested in authoritarian rhetoric and strategies, if not a full-on regime, that he feels and agrees that he should be unchecked by Congress and the Supreme Court. We watched him put in the Supreme Court nominee in a matter of days. And I also think it means that we're going to have to engage in a lot of civil unrest to make our democratic ideals known. We've seen that at the ballot box, it's not being represented or kind of adequately reflected. So I think we can expect a lot of kind of counterbalance in the form of civil protest as well.
Okay, Shadi, let me put this to you. I mean, you have said that, you know, we're a democracy. If you don't like him, you can vote him out, that, you know, our guardrails and structures are largely still in place. But if Donald Trump wins, where do you think we're headed with all of those things?
Yeah, I mean, one reason I really hope Donald Trump doesn't win is so we can avoid testing this proposition. I feel like we've acquitted ourselves pretty well the past 4 years. It was a difficult test. It was challenging, but America has been resilient. I don't know if I want to have four more years of stress on the system. Trump is a chaos agent. He poisons everything he touches. He polarizes American politics. He makes Americans turn against each other. I think we'll If in the worst case scenario, he wins and he ekes out a close victory, it'll be a tough 4 years. I think we'll be able to get past it again because we're more resilient often than we think. But it will not be an easy time. And I think Americans writ large, we need to have some relief after the exhaustion of the past 4 years. And also, I think it's worth noting one thing that Trump has been quite bad at is emboldening autocrats abroad. I mean, we haven't talked about that as much, but Trump doesn't care about human rights abroad. He doesn't talk about supporting democracy. He's close buddies with some of the worst authoritarians in the world, like Sisi in Egypt or MBS in Saudi Arabia. So that's, in some ways, the part that I'm more worried about. In Russia, Putin, yeah. Mm-hmm. The list is long. Mm-hmm. And I think that four more years of Trump turning a blind eye to human rights abuses in key countries, that's not good, obviously, and another reason to hope that there's a certain outcome.
I think that's a great point that Shadi made, Ruth. If Donald Trump wins and gets four more years in the U.S., what do you think that means for democracy in the U.S. and broader? Because Shadi makes a very good point. I mean, that Donald Trump and what happens in the U.S. has a knock-on effect in so many other places.
I was about to make the same point, in fact. That there's also the issue of, you can call it contagion, you can call it example, but when there are leaders who want to upend the international order, which he clearly does, think of the number of treaties and conventions that the U.S. has withdrawn from. Think of the reconfiguring of our alliances. This is huge. This is a part where we get so rightfully so wrapped up with what is going on inside our very enormous country that it's hard to step back. I've been calling this Axis 2.0 since 2016. Again, not because it's fascist, because that's not the right word to refer to Erdogan and Putin. A lot of the thing that's going on, and this relates back to the strongman thing, these are rulers who also use their personal relationships based on mutual profit. They're all about exploitation and making money. And foreign policy becomes subjugated to their private deals with other despots. And so this is something that will continue on if he is reelected.
Okay, that will be the final word. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, Shadi Hamid, Ashley Farmer, thank you all for joining us for this discussion. We appreciate it very much. And that is the show for this week. Up Front, we'll be back next week.